Shape 4. Scanning the field with one's non-innocent curiosity. This tape is made for a solitary movement with your non-innocent curiosity. Its embodied and political nature and drive. As an etymology amateur, which is to say lover, I began stitching this tape by reminding myself of curiosity's roots. Curiosity, from the Latin word curiositas, desire for knowledge that derives from curiosus, careful or diligent, from cura, meaning care or concern. Curiosity, interest, affinity, attraction, attachment, fascination, stuck with, wonder, destruction, reorientation, sudden, swelling, shimmering, quietly or sharp, acute, urgent, a need to know, or not to know. Curiosity, from early 17th century, desire to see and learn what's strange or unknown, an object of interest, something rare or strange. Novelty, discovery, exploration, surprise, grab tight, exoticizing, fetish, cabinets of curiosity. Curiosity, an orientation device with distinct politics. Non-innocent, that is to say, political. Non-innocence, a long-standing concern in diverse critical epistemological endeavors, or broadly speaking, and more quotidianly, diverse practices of knowledge-seeking. Not to be guilty of feeling, but aware of specific mutual embodiments curiosity ignites. Attentive to where curiosity orients you, where it comes from and how it sits in your body. Once again, the aim of this tape is to offer one soft scaffolding for a pause and reflections. Reflections on what you have been drawn to and might say you are becoming curious about. Settings. We're halfway through this residency and we are likely to feel full, saturated and possibly somewhat overwhelmed. And I invite each of us to take a moment, approximately this 1 hour, to flip through the pages of our notebooks and do that in this virtual company of several authors, to further spill the thoughts and affects to each other during our whole second week together. And if you'd like, we can surely gather in the room, read the texts, read the prompts, and also follow them together. Reading material. Above all, your notebooks and your notes. But also, a set of passages from Kathleen Stewart's work, from the work by Eliza Steinbach and Eva Hayward, followed by one simple but two-folded prompt, informed by the work of Tina Kampt, who is an exquisite listener to images, and my friend Joss Allen, who gardens, researches and writes about seed libraries and labour of commoning. Extra material. It would be good to find one photo you might have taken with your phone or your camera while field working. If you draw, then pull closer your drawing notebooks. Your body-mind, that thing that needs, is also that thing that senses, and senses in ways informed by the temporal and spatial locatedness, political orientations, bodily specificities. Senses also make our affective lives more intelligible. And so is power. It's also of senses. In addition to being that thing of capital, history, of inheritance, of community, if understood as a quality of relations, of all the other things, of all the many things we can imagine. Power dwells as that thing of senses in one's quotidian experience, surely in field working, but also in Kathleen Stewart's work. Some of us might know Kathleen Stewart, especially if we work with ethnography, affect, creative writing, if we work in performance studies or in drama. Kathleen Stewart writes that power lives as a capacity or a yearning, as a festering resentment. It can be centralized in night rages. It can begin as a secret kept or as a gesture glimpsed in a hallway. It can be leaked or harvested for future reference. It can spread like wildflower seeds randomly tossed on a suburban lawn. We do things with power and to power. There are palpable pleasures and eight stomachs in questioning it, spying on it, digging it up, calling it out, evading it, ingratiating oneself to it, sacrificing oneself on its altar, putting something over on it, or somehow coming to rest outside its whirlpool, even for a minute. Coming to rest outside its whirlpool, following one's curiosity, while at the residency during the time and space devoted to verb in a field, curiosity that might be born out of difficulty or, etymologically speaking, care for or concern with. What are you curious about? An object, experience, perhaps a relation? What are you concerned with? If curiosity is a sensorial power, where does it sit in your body? can you put your palm on that spot? How does it animate you? Does it make you feel restless? Or does it make you feel numb? Is it on the tips of your fingers or in your stomach? How does it contour the field for you? Does it fence a field or blows it up, dispersing it? What does this curiosity, restless or numbing, care for? What is this something that needs to rest outside the whirlpool of the current system of dominance and its infrastructures? Before stitching this tape, I had dwelt for quite some time with curiosity as it's figured by transfeminist scholar Elinza Steinbock. Curiosity, an affect of seeking and potentially a process of holding, an effective technique born of difficulty. Specifically for Elinza Steinbock's work, born out of difficulty in trans lives. A survival technique that draws on the effective form of rage to give birth to virtual possibilities and actualities of trans life. Working with bodies of films as their companions rather than reading films as one does in conventional film studies, Elinza speaks of curiosity as an affect and attitude that scans. It scans a waiting for and co-making alternate trans worldings. Curiosity is a mode of scanning for alternate trans worldings. Scanning. A participatory technology that constitutes the space and is not only about grasping the pre-formed elements of that space. The perspectival mode of scanning emphasizes how one's ray of attention not only connects with, but also actively creates the image world. Scanning, close reading for nuance. Traceable through the etymological root nue, to shade, from the old French nu, cloud, in the sense of scanning clouds for signs of imminent weather or enjoying the play of light in the clouds. In my practice, I scan curiously through the thick of transphobic atmospheres, but also through all the atmospheres that are structurally disabling and usually in some ways relevant for me. I scan queer creepily. Transcuriosity will always have its root in gendered agenda for me, but it will always unavoidably spill towards broader systemic transformations. Transformative. And here I am with Eva Hayward. Transformative. That starts in one place and ends in another place. Trans, a sensorial and affective doing, and yes, also the prefix, weighted with a cross beyond through, into another state or place, elsewhere. The prefix does now familiar work of suggesting the unclassifiable, something what the system of dominance can't or is not interested to detect. To trance, to transcend, to surpass, to transgress, particular impositions, empirical, rhetorical, aesthetic, affective, sensorial, imaginative. Transgression, produced through emotive forces of which curiosity must be one. Laborious, sweaty, sticky, sticking together, shards and pieces of transgressed worlds, reworking them into meaningful integrities. What does your curiosity desire to transgress? Exactly, precisely. What does it scan for? For clarity, for cartography, for affect, for experience, for a relation. What does your curiosity desire to hold? Does it hold tight? Too tight, perhaps, or too softly? The next part of this tape invites you to listen to Eva Hayward for a little longer, to listen to her describing her experience of sensing and feeling mutual embodiments, topically for us emerging at the lab, with her not being a scientist there but an artist and a writer and further a gender studies scholar. This next part of the tape invites you to check your phones and cameras or your drawing notebooks and then take a moment to listen to the photo that you decide to work with. To mutual embodiments emerging with it and reflect on the interest or curiosity that attracted you to what happens in the photo. And for that, Eva Hayward's writing is followed by one simple, though twofold, prompt for listening to images that Joss Allen and Tina Camp in their virtual dialogue taught me. Eva Hayward, envisioning invertebrates and other aquatic encounters. Preface, imminent images. In 1992, after a brief start in studio art, sculpture, at Dartmouth College, I began an undergraduate degree in human ecology at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. As part of my financial package, I was given a work-study position with Allied Whale, a marine mammal research unit at COA. At the time, it seemed an unlikely match. How would my skill as a ceramicist prepare me for biological research? And still, I was excited. I wondered how biological practices, studies in ecology would help shape my artwork. Would whale population studies, genetic and photographic, inform my attention to formal elements in ceramics, perhaps? How would my attention to the chemistry of clay and glaze inform the way that I researched? Could an artist offer something to scientific inquiry? On the third floor of Carrots, in a small office overlooking Frenchman Bay, I worked closely with Dan Dean Danto, Judith Allen, Steve Katona, and Peter Sturvik on the North Atlantic Humber Catalogue. The catalogue was comprised of photographs of the underside of the whale flukes, or the whale tails, totally at that time roughly 6,000 individuals. Each fluke displayed unique markings, not unlike fingerprints, that could be identified in a process called photo ID. Steve Katona developed a photo ID technique while in graduate school. After years of field research, he began to recognize individuals by the markings on their flukes. He proposed that these markings served as fingerprints that could be used to define populations into individuals, allowing researchers to study a single animal over its lifetime. Photo ID allowed marine scientists access to humpback whales in ways that were otherwise impossible. I remember many hours sitting at a makeshift desk or light table taking new photographs from the field and taking a photograph and comparing it with known individuals against the catalogue. Each catalogue was organized by region, coastal Maine, East Coast regions of Canada, Greenland, and etc., and by known individuals from other regions, Cassiopeia, Lighthouse, Salt. A research expedition, under the right conditions, could capture hundreds of images of familiar and new whales. Photographic studies of migratory patterns, studying where individuals wintered, summered, fed, allowed us at Allied Whales to understand tendencies in the behaviors of various populations. If a photograph were particularly poor, bad framing in rough waters, but still offered bits of detail, I would spend 4 to 5 days matching it through a 25-volume catalogue, starting with the most likely locations and moving outward from there. Sometimes a poor photograph would circulate the entire office, all our fingers and eyes, scoring the image for some precious and overlooked detail, everyone trying their luck at matching the new image with another. Even with care, the photograph would become worn and slightly bent by the end of its own migration through the office. Noticing how these photos of migrating whales studied by traveling researchers, at least 2 expeditions a year were expected. They circulated in the office made me aware of the complex, material and fleshy relationships between photo, whale and researcher. In some very important way, all the actors were mutually implicated in the concerns and activities of each other's lives. Human-animal, non-human-animal and apparatuses were co-constitutive in the process of trying to know something about whale ecology. The photograph seemed as if it were a concrescence, a literal materialization of a dynamic produced through the interactions of these various organic and inorganic actors. In my hands, I held an object that wasn't just a still record of a whale that had been there, but a bumptious and lively event of the processes of whale studies and whales themselves. The photograph wasn't just a representation of the event, it was of the event. The photograph was only one part, a kind of lively limb of the relay. Looking at a single photo for a while, I would begin to translate their representation into the sensuous materiality of their taking. I reconstituted in my own body the experience that I imagined the photographer to have had. That is, the image was a kind of connective tissue to the originary physical event. I knew I wasn't having the same experience as the photographers. I wasn't borrowing their bodies. But the photograph solicited my senses. Without knowing it, I was beginning to understand what Barthes, who I hadn't known yet, encountered when saying or speaking of the umbilicus of light that connects the referent, the real object, with its representation. The solar light that brushed up against, even touched the whale, was translated through the camera into film, into chemical baths, into photo paper, and through my eye as a research assistant. I was sensuously evoked, longing for a port with the whale where I was drawn beyond the sense of my own boundaries. I acted wantonly. The photograph moved me deeply and touched me throughout, steering my bodily senses at my sense of my body. I learned to see that photographs were not transcendent or discrete, but rather their material, immanent and interconnected. As some of the flukes were encrusted with barnacles, the photograph itself was an accretion of experience. I began to sense and make sense of the intercorporeal relationship between me and the photograph and the whale. I shared in the event of the photographic space, a mutual embodiment. The photo provided its own somatic intelligibility to my own somatic intelligence of the events appearing in the photograph. Put another way, we could say that the photograph enacted an encounter between subjective feelings and objective knowledges between the senses and their sense. I did not recognize a structural lack or primordial division between referent and representation or object and subject, but I did feel continuity between the physiological and affective responses of my own body, the bodies in the photograph and the bodies that produced the photograph. In retrospect, I see my experience of these photographs as an instance of sensuous knowledge, the way we are in some carnal modality able to touch and be touched by the substance of images, to feel a visual atmosphere envelope us, to dive into some events as we are relatively bound to our seats. My embodiment was both mine and not my own, opened to the mattering of flesh. Diffusely, ambivalently, the whale's body, researcher's body, the photographer's body, and my own body. I want to insist that I am not speaking metaphorically of embodying and being embodied, but quite literally of my capacity to feel the world I encountered in and of these photographs. As philosopher Elizabeth Gross puts it, things solicit the flesh just as the flesh beckons to and as an object for things. Perception is the flesh's reversibility, the flesh touching, seeing, perceiving itself, one fold provisionally, catching the other in its own self-embrace. Experiencing these photographs was not ever merely seeing them. My lived body encountered the various bodies composing the photograph. Commingling flesh and consciousness, the human animal and technological sensorium saw that meaning and where it's made did not have a discrete origin in whales, humans or technologies, but emerged from all. My experience at Allied Whale has informed this dissertation. And what I'm reading to you is indeed the preface of Eva Hayward's doctoral dissertation. Although my attention has shifted to invertebrates, my address has not changed. I remain concerned about the role of embodiment in visual cultures. I continue to wonder about how Can I rethink the relationship between observer and image, not as antagonistic but as mutual embodiment? How might my senses help me to be sensible about that thing that draws my attention? How do I invoke I when I theorize or conceptualize with that thing that draws my attention? How can my experiences be about exposition of the way the world can be said to be working? And now, let's choose a photo. The one that loudly calls for you from your feed, or maybe the one that you are surprised you took. It can also be a scene that you remember or a drawing you made. And next, I'd like to virtually introduce you to my friend, Joss Allen, and more specifically one attention work exercise that I picked up from him and that works without failure. It keeps grounding me in my fieldworking and writing, and when I need to contour or nuance a spatial situation of an event or a story I might be writing up, especially helpful it is when I'm lifting an event or a story from a scene in my memory. And I tend to remember everything in scenes. During their own residency in Norway, Joss walked from Sogndal to Sandbeck with the ongoing socio-environmental histories of mining in the region, with titanium dioxide and ilmenite that give characteristic wild sheen to the milieu, the colour of erasure, as Joss wrote. In placing and locating the histories and currents and contouring one of his fields, Joss looked for seven other whites, scanning for specific colors and color rhymes to contour one's field. And I promise, it's a simple yet evocative exercise. When I'm stuck or can't choose the first hook to a story of a noisy scene I remember, and all the scenes are noisy, I now contour it with colors, companion colors meaningful to the story I mean to tell, or I might feel I will be telling. In Kilpisjärvi, this companion color of mine might be the color of bilberry plants or a color of bilberry. It's also a blueberry, so does its blue resemble wet silk or warm velvet? Is it pitch black? Where does the blue of bilberry spill? What does it rhyme with in the milieu? Slowly scanning for this color, I will have grounded myself, likely spill over the frames of a photograph or a scene I might imagine, and I will feel less unsure-footed, which I am likely to feel when saturated with all the new noticings, details, and tickled, if not made restless by curiosity. And I invite you to scan for your specific whites or blues or greens or maybe iridescence on the photograph of your choice or in the scene that you remember, to start unraveling the affective drive of interest or curiosity that made you take this photo that's in front of you. Describe your blue or white or black or green in detail. Rhyme it synesthetically. Find haptic siblings to your color on the photo. Describe it in irritating detail. And now, let's listen to the space you scanned for and contoured, and to the photograph or the scene with Tina Kampt, who is known to masterfully listen to images and in her work in the context of material reality of Black lives, both in dailiness but also in arts. If we literally try to hear something that's not necessarily visualized in the image, then listen to images becomes a way of enacting the broader experience of how images register. How do you get access to those deeper resonances? What are the frequencies of your image, the photo, or the scene, or the drawing? Frequency, a sonic, in terms of sound waves. Visual, in terms of light waves and how they register. Temporal, in terms of repetition. Kinetic, in terms of movement. Haptic, in terms of how it moves us and the ways these forms of responsiveness affect our relationships to one another. And by the way, how did you know the permission to take that photo was granted.